Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Gone Medieval from History Hit. My name is Dr. Kat Jarman and today I've got some very special exclusive content for you because right now I am in the far northeast of England. I'm in Northumberland, warming up after a particularly freezing day digging holes in the field. And I'm here because I'm part of a team that has started investigating a brand new Viking site that has just been identified. And in today's podcast, I'm very excited to be able to share for the very first time and exclusively for Gone Medieval, the lowdown on this brand new discovery. And with me now, I have the archaeologist in charge of the project, my brilliant colleague, Dr. Jane Kershaw. Jane is an assistant professor at the University of Oxford, so thanks so much for agreeing to share this with us, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Jane specialises in the Viking Age, and especially in Viking Age metalwork. And as we'll hear in a moment, metal artefacts were actually key to finding the site in the first place. And we're going to go back to that very specific site and this new discovery in a moment, but we just need to start out with some of the background information about the site. So I thought we could start with the particular group of Vikings that we're talking about here, namely the so-called Great Army or Great Heathen Army. And in case our listeners aren't really that familiar with the Great Army, Jane, can you just tell us briefly about who these people were?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are first recorded as arriving in England in 865. So this is after a period of 70 years or so of Viking raiding. But in this year, a great army arrives. They're a motley collection of kind of career warriors, mostly from Scandinavia, maybe some people coming from the continent, possibly from Ireland as well. And they travel round England, subduing the various Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. They take East Anglia, they go and they capture York, they're capturing parts of Mercia as well. And this activity is taking place in the late 860s and 70s, and we have historical documents that tell us where they overwinter. And it's these winter campsites that archaeologists have been investigating and that we're learning a lot more about.
I should say at this point that the work that I've been doing in the last decade or so is looking at some of these camps. So I've got a special interest. And one of those camps is the site called Repton in Derbyshire. And that's probably the camp that we know the most about because we have the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle record of it, and then the archaeologists backed it up. Another site for 872 is a site called Torksey in Lincolnshire. And they've been really, really important because they match the historical record with the archaeology. But crucially, this far north, we don't really have any evidence of any of those camps, do we?
No, the archaeological evidence has been non-existent for Vikings this far north. We are well north of the Tyne. But we pick up the story in Repton after the Vikings have been there in 873, and where do they go next? The historical sources say that actually the Great Army splits at this point. Most of what the sources call the host, which is the army, go south and settle in the south of England, especially East Anglia. But a part of the army goes north and it heads to the River Tyne.
Yes, and I should say at this moment as well, if you want to find out more about the Great Army, you can also check out more about their activities in the south of England, culminating in the legendary Battle of Edington. Check out the new documentary on that topic on History Hit, where Dan Snow and I went on a road trip across the country to search for evidence of the Great Army. But let's go back to the north again. So the historical records do mention then that the Great Army, or at least part of the Great Army, goes north and goes actually into Northumbria. What exactly do they say, and who? And we've got some names, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. And it's interesting because a lot of different written sources all say the same thing, which is that a Viking leader called Halfdan, so one of the leaders of the Great Army, takes part of the troops there, and they all agree, all the sources agree, that he enters Northumbria on the Tyne. So we're confident that along the Tyne somewhere is a Viking army base.
But so far, nobody's really worked out where that was.
There is no evidence whatsoever. There have been suggestions based on likely positions, like Tynemouth itself is a likely location because there were some Anglo-Saxon monasteries there, and maybe that was a source of wealth for the Vikings. There was a natural harbour in that area, so it's been suggested that maybe they didn't sail that far down the Tyne and stayed near the coast, but really we have no physical evidence.
So we know Halfdan goes north, we know he comes here, but then what does he do? I mean, what else happens? And could you possibly say a little bit more about the context of this kingdom of Northumbria? You know, what else was here? What could he have wanted?
He's already taken York. So the Viking army have taken York in the 860s. York is the centre of the Northumbrian Anglo-Saxon kingdom at that stage. There are other centres that become very important. So Bamber, further north on the coast, and of course Lindisfarne, which the Vikings have earlier raided. And these monasteries I just mentioned around the mouth of the Tyne, a cluster of Anglo-Saxon monasteries also raided much earlier on around 800 by the Vikings. So this is an area that Vikings have previously attacked and extracted wealth out of. But when we join them again in the 870s, they're still interested in raiding, but we're in a different phase of Viking activity where raiding is soon turning to settlement.
Let's bring it back to the new discovery and the reason why we're up here and why we were shivering in a very rainy, wet April field today. How did this new discovery come about? What was it that made you narrow in on this particular location?
Because the historical sources just mentioned the Tyne, but we're much further north than that. So we've travelled up the Northumbrian coast, we're in the beautiful Coquet Valley, and the site first came to light from the metal detector finds. And these metal detectorists have been working the site for around 15 years. They've been carefully recording where they discovered their finds, reporting it to the National Portable Antiquities Scheme. And that has allowed us to identify this site as really significant in its regional context. And that's what first drew us here. And there was a lovely assemblage of Viking Age material, not standout stuff, not kind of gold and silver that attracts a lot of attention, but actually more mundane pieces that nonetheless we tie now to Viking camps and the Great Army. So we have a selection of lead gaming pieces, for instance. So pieces that would have been used as markers on boards that members of the Great Army are playing during their copious downtime in between raiding activities, whiling away their time in the same muddy field we were in today. There are lots of Anglo-Saxon dress accessories. Although they're Anglo-Saxon, they turn up at Viking camps. We're not really sure how they're being used, but these are fittings for belts and pins and things like that. And also the local coinage, which isn't actually a silver coinage, but which is copper alloy. So it's a very kind of low denominational coinage, but it's a recurring feature at Viking campsites, and we have it here.
Yeah, so that's the key, isn't it? This is essentially now we recognise as a kind of signature for these Great Army camps, and they don't happen before we start hearing about the Great Army sites, and they don't really happen afterwards either. So, you know, if you go into the 900s, you don't get that same signature, you don't get the gaming pieces. They seem extremely specific, and we know because we have them at somewhere like Repton, where we've got the historically documented evidence, you can use that evidence and you can sort of take that elsewhere. So that all fitted really well, didn't it?
It did. And the coinage is especially helpful because then we can say, it's not an exact date that it offers, but we can say this was coinage produced in the 850s, 860s, it points us towards a certain period of use. So it's not purely guesswork. You know, we have some dating evidence there.
So we think this happens after 873.
Mm-hmm.
And you think it's quite soon after, in the next year or two, probably?
I do, because the historical sources are clear that it's 875 that the Viking army, part of the army, heads to the Tyne. And there, the sources say, Halfdan raided among the Picts and the Strathclyde Britons. These are populations, so Scotland and northwest England and southern Scotland towards the west coast. These are populations further north than where we are now. So it makes sense that the Viking Great Army is on the Tyne. They're heading up further north to raid in these northern zones. And on the way, they pass the Coquet.
So the Coquet is a river that goes from the North Sea and a bit further inland. And then the site is in that valley. So it's accessible from the coast.
Exactly. It's perhaps best known today for Warkworth Castle, which is a prominent local feature. But also on the coast itself, you have Coquet Island, a very small island today. It's a bird reserve, but a very convenient navigational waypoint. So if you were sailing up the coast, you come to this island, you can turn in at modern day Amble, where we're sitting now, and you can row up the river.
It fits into that pattern. We've got the objects that sort of scream Viking Great Army mm-hmm. at us, and it makes sense as a location. We know that some of them went up here. But let's talk a little bit more in sort of like general terms about the site, because that's another thing that we've been trying to understand in recent years. These campsites, these locations that were used by the Vikings, we know that they spend the winter there. So some of it is literally somewhere you can shelter and you can settle. They need to be defendable, essentially. You need to be able to make sure you keep people safe. It used to be thought that these were fortifications, because sometimes in the records they talk about fortifications. We don't have any evidence or any sign of fortifications here, do we? And instead, they are taking advantage of something else.
The site is a naturally defensive site. It's an area of high ground with quite steep falls on at least three sides, easy access to the river, which is great for looking out and keeping an eye on potential enemies. And it also gives you access if you need to get out to the coast to get away. So we're not necessarily looking for built structures, the forts or ditches necessarily, but we're more looking for a prominent position in the landscape that takes advantage of the natural features. Because these sites are temporary sites. These are very short-lived, probably a year or so. Maybe they come back after a little while, but these are not permanent settlements. So we need to understand these as not sites that people are going to invest a great deal in terms of more permanent structures.
So really, when we continue with our excavations, we're not really likely to find, we're not going to find buildings, we're not going to find anything major like that. I mean, what do you think we're going to find when we continue?
I hope very much we'll find more finds, like more small finds, small pieces of metalwork, which are so informative about this site. We might find some burials. One of the really interesting things about this site is that it is not just occupied in the Viking Age. There is evidence for earlier Anglo-Saxon activity, high status Anglo-Saxon activity. Whether this is something like a market site or more likely a cemetery is yet to be seen, but there's clearly early Anglo-Saxon activity. And going back even earlier, there's Roman activity, which is really interesting this far north. Yeah, we're well north of Hadrian's Wall. There's late Roman activity, which you don't get a lot of in Northumberland. And it might be connected to the building of the Antonine Wall, even further north than where we are now. So this has a longer history, I guess, this site. It's a site that the Vikings didn't necessarily have to identify for themselves as somewhere prominent. They would have been attracted to an already high status site.
Have you heard of the teenage werewolf prosecuted in 1603? Did you know that the 17th century British government relied heavily on female spies? And do you want to know about chin chucking and thigh sex? Of course you do. I'm Susanna Lipscomb, and my new podcast, Not Just the Tudors, is a deep dive into what I like to think of as the long 16th century. We'll be talking about everything from Aztecs to witches, Velázquez to Shakespeare, Mughal India to the Mayflower. Not, in other words, just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Subscribe to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So there could possibly even have been some earlier features. And actually, we were walking around today, we were looking at some of our maps, drone images and LiDAR images and so on, and looking for some sites that, you know, perhaps somebody else, perhaps the Romans had built something there before. We're a bit unsure at the moment, so we've got to go back and investigate, but it's quite possible that that could have been there.
Indeed, and if we think about Torxi, for instance, they do actually have a Roman villa in the middle of that site, unclear about what would have been visible or in use at that stage, but it was a site that was occupied in the Roman period, as well as then being occupied later by the Viking Great Army. And I suspect it's highly likely that we have Roman activity and going back even earlier, Iron Age activity. It's a classic Iron Age fort sort of site.
And actually other sites like Thetford as well, for example, where we, again, there's another winter camp we've not yet identified, but that also has a very prominent Iron Age hill fort. So there are fortifications. Again, it's located by a river. So it fits that pattern extremely well, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, increasingly as we add more and more of these sites to our repertoire, we can see recurring features.
But if you go to this whole valley today, it's pretty quiet. There's not a lot. There's beautiful villages, there's lovely bridges. We found a lovely pub yesterday where we could sit outside and have, maybe have a drink. But there's not really anything else there. So obviously we talked about the river, the fact that they're going north. But, you know, was there anything else here for them? Was this a destination itself apart from that? Or was it more of a sort of strategic choice to come up to a place like this?
It is strategic, and a really important feature of this site is that it is not enemy territory. These lands had been owned by the Anglo-Saxon monastery, the community of Lindisfarne, but they were taken over by an Anglo-Saxon king who was then killed by the Vikings in York. And when he died, his lands would have passed over to the Viking rulers. In principle, you know, whether in reality there were client kings involved, you know, ruling day to day is open to question. But it means that the Vikings who rode into the River Coquet were in charge of this area. So it was, in a way, a safe haven, and it could have been a really convenient and safe base from which to plan attacks further north and northwest.
And that's something that we can really visualise, I think, when you go out there in the landscape. And things like how you travel. So obviously we've talked about the river and the fact, and as you will know, I'm slightly obsessed with how the Vikings used rivers in different parts of the world. And in other parts of Europe, like in Eastern Europe, the rivers are absolutely key to what the Vikings are doing. And here too, we can imagine that if they are going raiding inland, We know that this is a force that goes in part on land, but also by boat. So they have boats, they have ships that are going to be very valuable. And then we were discussing earlier on today, what do you do with those ships? If you're raiding in land, where are you going to keep them? And could that be the sort of function of a site like this as well?
Definitely. I think that's a critical part. You need somewhere to keep your ships safe, somewhere where you can repair them, mend the sail if necessary, and where the crew can rest, but also where you have them at the ready. So if you need them and you need to get away quickly, you can do that. So a safe place where you can easily manoeuvre a fleet is vital. But what's interesting about this site is that not only do you have the access to the rivers and then the coast, but you also have a Roman road infrastructure that can take you inland. So you can go on a road that's known as the Devil's Causeway. You can go into northeast Northumbria as far as Berwick-upon-Tweed, but it can also take you to the Lower Tyne Valley, where it connects to other Roman roads to take you further inland and further west. So you have both overland routes and riverine routes.
So it's just perfect strategic. So if you're somebody like Halfdan, who's got ambitions to do something. So what, actually, let's stop on that. What is he trying to do you think?
It's a good question. I mean, the sources say that Halfdan is intent on pillaging and raiding this area, on attacking the churches and monasteries. Now, we sort of have to take that with a pinch of salt, because these are sources that want to claim they are the victims of Viking raids. But we do get the sense from the sources that Halfdan is quite a character. And this is in the context of a cast of really big characters. Any Viking leader is going to be quite a character at this stage. But Halfdan seems quite special. He's someone that leads troops up into Scotland. We know that he fights in Scotland at Dollar and Athol for up to a year, quite a long time. He then comes back. He settles in Yorkshire with his army, but the settled life is not for him. He's keen to keep on raiding, to try to continue this campaign of warfare, and he tries to muster his men to do this. They don't want any part of it, and in the end he leaves the Tyne again with just 3 ships, the sources say, and he goes to Ireland, where he's involved in the killing of his nephew, and shortly after that he himself is killed. So he doesn't survive that much longer, but he's someone who is a warrior up until the end and doesn't seem to want to settle down and plough the land like the rest of his followers.
And can we just touch on that one source that says something about him leaving the country? Because that's quite an interesting one, because it actually gives a bit of a reason for what happened with him and why people didn't want anything to do with Halfdan anymore.
Indeed. So this is an early 12th century source. So it's a little bit after our period. So again, grain of salt required. But it says that Halfdan was attacked by mental insanity and by the severest bodily odour. And that was why none of his followers wanted to go with him. So he's leaving the Tyne stinking, not able to gain any more loyalty or support from the people that have followed him thus far. And so he heads off to Ireland in disgrace and smelling really bad.
Poor Halfdan.
Poor Halfdan. Yeah.
Okay, so moving on. Moving just back to the new site and the new discovery. What's the significance of finding a site in Northumbria, do you think? I mean, do we need to? Is it important? And what can that really tell us?
It is important. This is not an area of the country that has a lot of archaeological material for the early medieval periods, if the Anglo-Saxon and the Viking Age. And really, Viking history has no place here so far. We have these historical references, but actually they've not been investigated. They've kind of been overlooked in favour of places in the country where we do have much richer archaeological evidence, like Yorkshire and East Anglia. So I feel like this site is filling a gap in our knowledge and actually drawing attention to the very far reach of the Viking Great Army. They're travelling up and down the country. Literally, we're going to the far, far north of England here. And they're going from England into Scotland. So this is a link between what's happening in England, what's happening in Scotland, and that is also connected to what's happening in Ireland. So they're not separate movements. They're all interrelated. The same players are involved in all 3 areas.
This really could be a very important puzzle piece in that big picture. which is exciting and it's brilliant because we don't get new Viking sites very often. There really are quite a few and far between.
And if it wasn't for the careful reporting of these finds over the years, you know, I think we have a contrast here with somewhere like Torksey that has an awful lot of finds recorded now, many, many man hours of metal detecting on the site. It's different here. It's not got the same hundreds or thousands of artifacts, but it's been a slow and steady build. And as a result, we've been able to identify fascinating sites.
And it's, as you said right at the beginning, these aren't the really amazing big hoards. They're not gold and silver. They are really kind of boring to a lot of people, everyday small objects. But the fact that these tell that bigger story is essentially what's so important about them. So hopefully we'll get more of those finds, more recorded, and then we can really fill in the picture.
Go and check your scrap boxes, because it might be that you have material that you don't think is interesting but we find fascinating.
So that's really brilliant. So we've just done a bit of digging, we've just got started here. I think we're really understanding the landscape, was beginning to understand the landscape. Some of that is the movement of the river in the past, because at the moment the way the river is flowing isn't necessarily the same as 1,000 years ago. So what we need to do is try to work out what that river used to do and how that affects our site. I have to be completely honest, in the last 2 days, we have found a few things, but no amazing discoveries just yet. And you and I dug a trench, a little test pit that had absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
In it, unfortunately. But we're not going to give up. So what's next for this site then?
So we've been just test pitting at the moment. So putting in very small trenches just to assess how deep is the archaeology. Are there other features? We do have features, just nothing that is very tangible at the moment. So we're coming back to the site. We're going to do a proper 2-week dig in September. And we really need to understand what's happening with the river. So I think some coring is needed, some kind of identifying the different phases of the landscape, how the land that has crops in it today would have been used in the past.
So that's going to tell us then, hopefully much more about who was here, how long they were here for, what sort of resources they had access to, how big the site was, because actually the area we're talking about, it's quite big, isn't it?
It's really substantial. I think our latest estimate was 42 or 43 hectares, which is comparable to the other sites that have been identified, like Torksey and Old Walk in Yorkshire as well. So it's definitely in the same league as that, which is interesting when we think about the sources and only part of the Viking army going north and the rest going south. But here the site is just as big as the campsites that have hosted the entire Viking army.
So we could be talking about a pretty substantial and pretty important site potentially.
Yeah, where nobody knew to expect it.
And that's what's so exciting. So literally a few years ago, absolutely no clue. And then the objects just bring this to life entirely. That's really, really exciting. Obviously, I'm excited because I'm involved in the project myself, but this is definitely one to look out for. So we will keep you updated. We will, as I said, be digging more, and Jane's going to be leading research going forward. So when there is some news, we'll make sure we bring it to you here. And if you do want to find out more about the Great Army as well, listen to some of the other podcasts on Dan Snow's History Hit and check out the new documentary about the Great Army on our road trip through the country looking for some of these sites as well. Hope you enjoy this episode. This was Dr. Jane Kershaw talking about the brand new Viking site in Northumberland. Thank you so much for joining me, Jane.
Thank you, it's been great.
And don't forget to subscribe to Gone Medieval, and you can find it anywhere where you find your podcast. Click that subscribe button, pretty please, and tell all your friends and family to do the same. And we will be back next week with more. I'm Dr. Kat Jarman, and I will see you again soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gone Medieval. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us out, and you'll be doing me a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code MEDIEVAL at checkout.